Welcome back to As If with Lisa Ferral, a contemporary art podcast. I am gonna film this one in my room today, and there is my bed in the back room. Sorry. I just kind of don't want to film in the living room, honestly. There's no other reason for it. If you're that person who likes the same type of setup every single time, sorry. But today we're actually going to talk about a couple of things that pertain to movies that are comedy, thrillers, as well as other forms of media and art that create a narrative that is sometimes a little bit over the top, to the point where the only thing you can really do is interpret wildly. And I feel like it happens often in art in general. Interpretation, I don't think it can be avoided. There is obviously conversation about that in art all the time. If you are in the arts, you are sick and tired of this conversation of, you know, is interpretation good or is it killing the artwork? Does it affect it in negative ways? Whatever. You might have not actually heard about it, or you might have not read Susan Sontag's essay against interpretation. So we're gonna talk about it because I feel like these types of movies, like Saltburn, because we're gonna be talking about Saltburn, those movies definitely invite interpretation, because they treat narrative as kind of a secondary or a supplementary thing oftentimes, you know, just because the shock value and the scenes that happen during the movie, sometimes they're just so out of nowhere, or they're so dramatic or unusual, let's say that way, that you kind of forget for a moment there. The movies usually involve a storyline that is somewhat clear, right? When it comes to Saltburn, I don't even care to discuss the specifics of the movie. We will talk about a couple of things, but I don't even care about the specifics because I just want to talk about the type of movie, because I feel like Saltburn is so quintessentially adjacent to art movies that we kind of have to dive into it and also talk about things like actor careers and how much movies like this can do for an actor. So first of all, let's talk about Saltburn. So Saltburn is a new movie from a director, Emerald Fennell, I think. Wait, how do you pronounce her name? Emerald Fennell, yeah. She's made Promising Young Woman. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie, but you probably have heard about it. It's kind of like a revenge movie, kind of like a horror flick, but not really. And it ends in a kind of depressing manner, while at the same time, it's kind of, I guess, satisfying in a way. I don't know. Anyway, this is a movie that, to me, seems to have a very different approach in terms of directing. Art direction wise, they're very, very different, at least in my opinion. I mean, you might gonna be able to find some kind of stylistic connections, but to me they seem very, very different. And we're also gonna talk about style today, by the way, what style even is. Somehow the director thinks that there is a huge connection between fame, fandom, and this movie. You do not actually get to see anybody who's like supposed to be famous within the world that we're in. So the metaphor or the parallel is very, they're far away from each other. Metaphorical comparison of this movie to whatever real life phenomena there is. So it's going to be a little bit difficult to really see what Emerald is going for. There is definitely a connection in a way. I have read some of her, you know, quotes on it and whatever. First and foremost, she explains, Saltburn is a movie about fame, fandom, and the internet and parasocial relationships, about the kind of connections people make from a distance and build into elaborate, often unhealthy fantasies. Part of drawing the line was making Felix the kind of superstar who would earn a fandom. He's handsome, charming, and skilled at everything he tries, but he's also surprisingly kind. Felix is like one of the main characters. And there's a lot of things that happen in this movie that are like surprising, I guess. One of them being that the other main character, who's like kind of obsessed or in love with Felix's character, who's played by Jacob Elordi, he like drinks bath water after Felix is done. How do I say this without getting demonetized? he's done taking a bath with some secretions being a part of it. Just put two and two together. I'm not about to lose my monetization because of this, okay? And there's also another scene where there's a wait. Listen, this is so hard to explain without like fucking being scared that it's gonna be, that my video is gonna get demonetized, but it's kind of like a game of charades. So put it together, right? Gravestone, a guy who was super obsessed with another guy who just drank contaminated water from a bath after that other person. So like there was another act that happened with that gravestone. Put two and two together. Honestly, none of this is like super shocking per se, mostly because of just the nature of our time and the way that our media is made. There's just so much shit going on at all times that nothing is really that surprising or shocking, really. Like, let's be for real here. Come on now. But I feel like this movie in particular, it kind of paints Felix and his family and like his wealth and everything as quite an attractive thing in terms of just how opulent it is, and you know, in many ways, the house, everything. But I feel like maybe it's just me, but I just don't think that this parasocial relationship thing or fame and wealth is translated very well nowadays for us, because I feel like most of the people that I see online, or when I see someone's house or whatever, most of the time, yeah, sometimes it happens that I look at it and I'm like, okay, that actually looks cute, but most of the time it's just god awful. It's ugly, it's tasteless, and it just kind of makes you wonder why those people even need money if they're gonna be spending it like this. But I just feel like maybe I think that maybe it's my problem, honestly, because I find no allure in rich people or famous people. Would like some money. I think it might be in some way because I'm just exposed to a lot of LA type of wealth, which does not appeal to me at all. Not aesthetically, not in terms of opportunities. Nothing about it seems attractive, right? But I think that in this movie, with the help of set design and the way that it's filmed, with some color grading, with some nice lenses, with a little bit of diffuser on top screwed on the lens, all of a sudden this house actually has something about it. You know, I think that maybe it's either that a lot of people who are famous right now just don't sell it well, I don't know what the issue is, or it's my issue, whatever, but I just was kind of surprised that Emerald thinks that there's that much of an obsessive attraction there to wealth. And maybe, again, I think that it's just like, maybe it's just me, so I'm not going to like dog on that too much. However, I do really like the subversion of, you know, the old school gothic country house situation, right? I believe Emerald is British. That would make a lot of sense, since she's like going for this whole vibe or this tradition, I would say, of writing about class and secrets. And honestly, there are a lot of gorgeous shots in the movie. Posters for the movie look amazing. All of them, honestly, look great. And I do appreciate that. However, I do always think about, what is it, a movie, and what is it something that would be better suited for a music video? The way that I always dog on Sam Levinson with his bullshit writing, where he's like, you know what? You could have just made a music video instead of spending millions upon millions of dollars on this fuck-ass show, honestly. I just think that it's really hard to find that balance of having gorgeous scenery, having great camera work and set design, but still not going too far into just camera gymnastics. This is an interesting addition to Fennell's career. I feel like I wouldn't have expected her to go in this direction after Promising Young Woman. I'm curious to see what this director is going to do in the future, but I think interpretation is actually something, again, I believe that interpretation is inevitable when it comes to art. I don't think you can just like look at art and not interpret it at all. However, there is one scene that recently I was reminded of because one of you sent me a clip of somebody talking about Stalker, this film by Andrei Tarkovsky. And I really like Tarkovsky. Tarkovsky is my favorite director. And in Stalker, there is a sequence where travelers, the three guys, are sitting on the rails, like on the thing that's moving on the rails. It's not really a train or something. It's like, it's a thing that they're sitting on. But it's not a train, okay? I don't know what to call it, but they're sitting on it. And for a while, it might be 10 minutes, it might be longer, whatever. I honestly don't know how long it was. But there's this scene where they're sitting and they're moving along and there's nothing going on. They're not talking. There's nothing very specific happening in the sense of our attention being directed by the camera. In a sense of, you know, sometimes you could be watching a sequence that doesn't really have anyone speaking in it or anything along those lines, but there's still choreography to the camera. There's still blocking to the camera that makes an object, for example, in the frame, the visual story of that portion of the film, where you can just kind of watch it move around and you know that you're watching the movement for a certain reason. Here in this particular movie, it did not feel like it was for any particular reason. But for some reason, it also works very, very well. And I was just sitting there thinking about it. I was like, wow, this is probably one of the only scenes that doesn't really invite me to interpret it, while at the same time, I still enjoy it. This kind of like trance-like state that you get into while watching it. You like start feeling like you are a traveler as well, in a sense of just feeling time, I guess. And I don't know what the reason for that scene is. And I, again, it's one of the only things, one of the only visual pieces of art that I do not really feel like I need to interpret while still enjoying it. Same with, which is really funny, but another example that I could remember was, again, Tarkovsky, his Solaris movie. And there is a scene where they're like in the spaceship or whatever, our space station, and there's like zero gravity moment, and they're just kind of, everything in the room is just kind of floating around with the people and everything, and there's beautiful music playing. I have no idea what it means. I can interpret it or whatever, but it's interesting that it's one of the only scenes that I enjoy so much just for what it is, that I don't really feel like I have to interpret it to still enjoy it. Which, I am an interpreter, okay? I am an interpreter girl. I love me art that makes sense. I love art that is complex, that involves a lot of theory. I absolutely fucking love it. If there's layers to an art piece where you can just keep on fucking peeling it away and the artist comes up with like their own theoretical background and they kind of create formulas for their artworks and how to read them or whatever, I fucking love that shit. I do. It's just mental gymnastics. It's not really better or worse than any other approach of art. It's just more entertaining to me, and then because I do love mental gymnastics. But it's interesting that there are any scenes that I could enjoy without wanting to interpret them. Actually, I realized that when I was watching Solaris, and it's my favorite movie, I genuinely don't think that I settled on any one interpretation at the end of the movie, and yet I still feel like it's my favorite movie. There's no other film that I could be watching and feeling like, and getting the same experience or feeling as when I'm watching scenes that are from Tarkovsky's movies. I do not know why, but a lot of films, even when they're gorgeous in a way that they were filmed, even when they're experimental and they're done really well and they capture something that's really hard to capture, it just doesn't feel the same, because something about the way that Tarkovsky films things and the way that his films feel, I wouldn't say they're like hyper-realistic, but something about the way that he chose his set design and the way he frames everything, every single frame, I wanna screenshot it and fucking frame it. I don't know what it is. Most scenes that I remember from movies, and I honestly don't remember movies that often because they just don't do it for me, but most of the scenes that I do remember that actually did impact not only me at the time when I was watching it, but impacted my entire approach to art, to visual art in general, was all Tarkovsky. And I don't know, sometimes I don't know why. I could come up with an interpretation as to why I like it. And I can find theoretical connections to something that I enjoy in art theory or whatever. But that's probably the only artist I wouldn't mind things to be up for interpretation. Because with most films, with most art, the work is not strong enough as a piece of visual art to just leave it be. But maybe it's just like not strong enough because it doesn't really need to be either. I don't know, because I feel like sometimes a lot of artists kind of, you know, they read Against Interpretation by Susan Sontag and they go, you know what? My artwork is like not up for interpretation. You actually are ruining it by trying to think about it too much or whatever, right? And to be honest, I think that it's usually a cop-out, because I'm sure based on just how Tarkovsky wrote about movies and whatever, he definitely had a reason for everything that he was doing. And he was very deliberate with his stories and with the way that he filmed everything, whatever, whatever. However, I don't know if I would use his work as like an example of a work that gets worse if you interpret it, because I don't think so. And this is something that Susan Sontag argues a lot in her essay. That's why I actually don't know if I agree or disagree. I kind of agree with some parts of her essay and I disagree with other parts. And I feel like that's actually a thing that I cannot really do in life, is that I cannot say to anybody what are my favorite things in art. Like, for example, this essay isn't my favorite essay. People oftentimes are like, did you like reading Susan Sontag? And it's like, well, yeah and no, because I guess that the way that I kind of separate writers or separate critics or philosophers or whatever is, did I get something out of it or was it a waste of time, rather than do I agree with them or do I not? Because most of the time I don't agree with anybody. Like, let's be for real, I am a difficult person. Like, I am not very simple in a way of like being able to understand others easily and agree with them on everything, or at least even on their like one work. I can tell you that, for example, Solaris is my favorite movie, but at the same time, whenever I say it, there's like 300 points that I have to mention afterwards explaining which parts actually spoke to me, and that it wasn't about this or that because I didn't like those parts or they did not do anything for me or whatever. And it's the same with the music. I do not have like one artist that I like or one album that I like entirely. I don't like anything entirely. That's the problem with me, I think. I can criticize anything, even my own works. I criticize them and don't agree with my own self after a while, after making something. Not entirely, I'm not completely, like, I don't think that there's that much of a difference, but sometimes it's still significant enough that I cannot even really recommend things to people because I feel like I enjoy very specific things about them, which other people might not even give a fuck about. Like, sometimes I like a song just because there's some sound in the percussion that I really enjoy. The rest of the song could fucking be, like, it could be ass. It could be absolute ass of a song. But there's, like, some percussive sound that I enjoy or I think is very innovative. And all of a sudden, this is my favorite song because it just did something for me, you know? And I think that this is the reason why when I'm talking about all of these critics or I'm talking about philosophers or something like that, I would say don't expect to read something that I'm talking about or that I'm recommending in quotations and think that this is an opinion that I agree with wholeheartedly. Because the way that I read things, it's literally like there are notes everywhere where I'm commenting, like, I find inconsistencies in the narrative, for example, and I'm like, girl, did you not notice that you're contradicting yourself or whatever? Like, I don't know why I'm like this. Don't question me. actually you can question me, but just like know that this is how it is. Anyway, against interpretation, first of all, it talks about mimesis, and mimesis is basically art that imitates reality, or it's mostly, yeah, just like imitation of reality, things that we see, trying to put them on a piece of paper as closely resembling reality as possible. But it can also involve things like impressionism and other things like that, that still have something recognizable in the picture frame, you know, like it doesn't have to be super photorealistic for it to still be mimesis in terms of the principle that's applied to the creation of the work. And I find that it's interesting that we start in Against Interpretation by Susan Sontag, we start with explanation of experience of art, the fact that it was kind of considered to be more magical at first than the first theory of art that was created by the Greek philosophers, which was mimesis. And when we talk about interpretation, specifically the definition of interpretation in Sontag's understanding within art history and art theory, is a conscious act of the mind which illustrates a certain code, certain rules of interpretation. This is definitely something that is honestly at the basis of a lot of critiques in the art world. I feel like even though this essay is quite popular, I feel like the interpretation specifically in terms of how to read an artwork or whatever is very, very popular. So I think that the reason why Sontag wrote this essay in particular was because she's trying to kind of speak on the fact that when you interpret things, you take the meaning, let's say the content of a form, of a thing, and you talk about it in a different form. You're trying to explain the meaning through a different medium, which is usually words, right? You explain the meaning of the work, therefore the person who interacts with interpretation is interacting with the interpretation rather than with the work itself. And it can kind of metaphorically kill the work itself by making the interpretation the main event. To quote her, it is the revenge of the intellect upon the world. To interpret is to impoverish, to deplete the world in order to set up a shadow world of meanings. It is to turn the world into this world, as if there were any other. The world, our world, is depleted, impoverished enough. Away with all duplicates of it until we again experience more immediately what we have. So I actually think that it's really interesting to think about how overstimulated we all are with images and interpretations of the world rather than the world itself. We don't really experience, for example, love at the level that is described in books or films or anything of that nature. We experience it through those artworks, in quotations, or media, entertainment, whatever it is, rather than we actually experience it immediately. Same with a lot of other things, like for example interpretations of how many people there are that are bad people, in quotations, and how we start to feel like everyone is a bad person based on not consistent, like everyday, for example, everyday experience of horrible people around you, which is questionable. I'm just saying that in like, just to explain the concept. And instead, we base it on specifically what has been said to us. I feel like it's less to do with interpretation as much as it is to do with taking other people's word over the actual experience or the artwork, which I feel like is kind of a separate issue than interpretation itself. However, when we put time as a part of this equation, right? So for example, there's an artwork and it gets interpreted, and then there's a lot of time that passed. That interpretation becomes very important, especially if it's been preserved, right? I have talked about it in the previous episode, saying that critics are really important for culture. And I feel like in this way, Sontag is kind of commenting on the fact that we are oftentimes working off of what has been said about the work than the work itself, especially when it comes to, for example, famous writers, philosophers, and whatever. She says, thick incrustations of interpretation have taken hold. But it should be noted that interpretation is not simply the complement that mediocrity pays to genius. It is indeed the modern way of understanding something and is applied to works of every quality. Thus, in the notes that Elia Kazan published on his production of A Streetcar Named Desire, it becomes clear that in order to direct the play, Kazan had to discover that Stanley Kowalski represented the sensual and vengeful barbarism that was engulfing our culture, while Blanche Dubois was Western civilization, poetry, delicate apparel, dim lighting, refined feelings, and all, though a little the worse for wear, to be sure. Tennessee Williams' forceful psychological melodrama now became intelligible. It was about something, about the decline of Western civilization. Apparently, were it to go on being a play about a handsome brute named Stanley Kowalski and a faded mangy belle named Blanche Dubois, it would not be manageable. It's interesting to me that she's talking about how this, what's his name? Kazan, had to know that this particular character represents something in order to direct him correctly. Which, I mean, honestly, I don't know if this, if it's really that fair to say that someone is incapable of directing something if they don't know the intentions behind the character, or if they do not interpret something, because I feel like it's inevitable. I just feel like it's inevitable to interpret something, especially when you are creating something like a play, or you're directing something that already exists. You take a work of art, a play, that is on a piece of paper, and you have to interpret it in order to bring it to life. Whether you're doing it right or wrong, whether you are interpreting it in a way that depletes the artwork, you're gonna have to do it anyway, because the production is, like, it's still gonna be an interpretation of the work. It's not an original. And also, it is still, especially productions, right, like plays and whatever, they involve so many people that you cannot say that this play is just the creation of this director. You can't say that, because there's just, like, even if you just take in consideration actors, if you've ever had to work with models, actors, anybody who is going to be bringing your vision to life physically, you know how much, like, how important it is to choose the right person, because you will not be able to control them entirely or even a little bit, really. You would be able to suggest things, but if they are not what you need or what this production needs, you will not get what you need. It's very important to choose the right person, because you can't just be like a kind of like a, like, you can't be a puppeteer to that degree. You can tell them what to say, you can even suggest how to say it, but there's a lot that rides on their physical presence. That's why it's such a difference, like, it's such a huge difference between being a director and an actor. And I feel like that's why I'm, like, constantly confused whenever I read Against Interpretation. Just as soon as I get what she's talking about, she throws in some kind of example that completely pulls this argument apart, in my opinion, because you can definitely argue against interpretation when it comes to a single object and you're talking about mimesis and its transition into separation of content and form and meaning and interpretation of specific pieces of art that don't involve like fucking 50 other people, right? Who are constantly going to be bringing different performances to the piece. I feel like this is kind of complicating the issue to another degree, in a way. So she, for example, speaks on a movie here too, right? So it starts with, it doesn't matter whether artists intend or don't intend for their works to be interpreted. That's true. Like, you can't, I mean, you can't really control that either, so it's not even, like, it's a non-question, but perhaps Tennessee Williams thinks Streetcar is about what Kazan thinks it to be about. It may be that Cocteau in The Blood of the Poet and Orpheus, one of the elaborate readings which have been given these films in terms of Freudian symbolism and social critique. But the merit of this work certainly lies elsewhere than in their meanings. Indeed, it is precisely to the extent that Williams' plays and Cocteau films do suggest these pretentious meanings, that they are defective, false, contrived, lacking in conviction. Those works will suggest meanings. You can't just make things, especially that have narratives, like literal things that are happening, that wouldn't suggest an interpretation or a few interpretations. You cannot expect a work to not, like, it's strange to say that a work of art is deficient because it causes interpretation or it is suggesting interpretation. Do I think, like, I don't know, it just seems like a little bit strange to say it that way, right? So from interviews, it appears that Resnais and Rob Grillet consciously designed last year at Marienbad to accommodate a multiplicity of equally plausible interpretations. But the temptation to interpret Marienbad should be resisted. What matters in Marienbad is the pure, untranslatable, sensuous immediacy of some of its images and its rigorous, if narrow, solutions to certain problems of cinematic form. And once again, this is where the argument falls apart for me again, because yes, there are scenes that to me might take away from them if you interpret them or whatever. As I've said, with Tarkovsky's scenes, some of them, I don't give a fuck to interpret them really, but it does not make it worse if you do interpret it. I don't think so. Specifically in this passage, it seems so strange to say that it should be resisted to interpret this work, and then she goes on to interpret it. Yes, it's not interpretation that suggests narrative, sure, but it's still an interpretation that tells you what is important, what is good about this work, what works about it. That's still an interpretation of the artwork. Obviously, she has separated the interpretation into different categories. There's an interpretation that you can create by just speaking on something in terms of form. Of course, to speak about a visual art, you will have to explain the form, what it actually is, what the scene is, or whatever, right? But at the same time, saying things like pure, untranslatable, sensuous immediacy of some of its images and its rigorous, if narrow, solutions of certain problems of cinematic form still suggests that even if it's a some kind of ineffable meaning, something that is not that concrete, it still suggests, again, what? Purity, untranslatable quality, and sensuous immediacy. And then later on, she also goes on to say things like, the sequence with the tank is the most striking moment in the film. And she goes on to say, those who reach for a Freudian interpretation of the tank are only expressing their lack of response to what is there on the screen. It is always the case that interpretation of this type of indicates a dissatisfaction, conscious or unconscious, with the work, a wish to replace it by something else. And once again, I don't know if it is, really. Because, okay, someone sees a tank and instead of just looking at the scene and its form, they start thinking about Freud or whatever, which is something that I do find annoying oftentimes. I have made jokes about it, about how people always look at a piece of art and they're like, this is so phallic, this is so vaginal, and it's like, oh my god, shut the fuck up, you know, like, how many times are you gonna say that? But at the same time, just because they have an interpretation does not mean, it doesn't replace the work. It just creates a reading, an interpretation. That's what I don't understand about sometimes, like, this whole text is just kind of like, as soon as I get what she's saying in terms of symbol, meaning, you know, the all of this conversation about semiotics and other shit like that within art, as soon as you're starting to kind of go, okay, I understand where you're going with this, even though it's shaky, I get it. But then there's like very specific examples of scenes that she finds to be the most striking scenes or whatever. That's already an interpretation, even though it is an interpretation of the form more than actual content, let's say. you still decide which one is more striking than the other, when in reality, a film, even though it is a sequence of a bunch of shots, is still in its entirety a piece of art. You cannot see one shot of the movie and say that this is the shot, mostly because if it was the shot, it would be a photograph. It wouldn't be a film. I feel like I'm going way too far into philosophy and like metaphysical bullshit at this point, and I just do not like it because it's just kind of fucking useless. To avoid interpretation, art may become parody, or it may become abstract, or it may become merely decorative, or it may become non-art. The flight from interpretation seems particularly a feature of modern painting. Abstract painting is the attempt to have, in the ordinary sense, no content. Since there is no content, there can be no interpretation. Pop art works by the opposite means to the same result. Using a content so blatant, so what it is, it too ends by being uninterpretable. A great deal of modern poetry as well, starting from the great experiments of French poetry, including the movement that is misleadingly called symbolism. To put silence into poems and reinstate the magic of the word has escaped from the rough grip of interpretation. To the extent that the novels and plays in America, unlike poetry and painting and music, don't reflect any interesting concern with changes in their form, these arts remain prone to assault by interpretation. But programmatic avant-gardism, which has meant mostly experiments with form at the expense of content, is not the only defense against infestation of art by interpretations. Ideally, it is possible to elude the interpreters in another way, by making works of art whose surface is so unified and clean, whose momentum is so rapid, whose address is so direct that the work can be just what it is. Is this possible now? It does happen in films, I believe. I don't know. Again, see? Sure. Let's say that something is so direct. Just as that scene that I told you about in Stalker by Tarkovsky. Let's say that this is the scene that kind of has that impact. At least it does to me. That it can just be what it is without having to be interpreted. That scene, even though it does exist and it does have that effect, I do not think that it was, that it is a piece of art on its own per se, especially because the point of even making that movie was not just to just create a pointless sequence that doesn't do anything. This is just a very strange conversation to me, and it's going to come up all, like, it's gonna come up over and over and over again if you go into art school, if you go into philosophy. And I think that a lot of people who study philosophy would give you a better answer, and they would be able to kind of point you in the right direction of who deciphers the issues of art better. But conversations about interpretation in particular, while they can be useful and interesting, like, for example, I find it really interesting that there are a few scenes in some movies that don't make me want to interpret it, but also doesn't make me want to turn it off and not watch it, you know? It does not mean that it can actually be some kind of proof that interpretation is always at the expense of the artwork, at the expense of its impact. Sometimes works of art can gain more importance over time in terms of, like, revisiting them. Even when you have read someone else's interpretations, if you don't take them as gospel, they could just be a suggestion that you kind of apply to this movie while you're watching it the second or the third or the fourth time, and you kind of go and decide whether it actually makes any fucking sense, logically speaking. However, if you want something to be so direct, right, so swift and so not requiring interpretation, you have to understand that it's going to be non-abstract, okay? Most of the time, it's going to be about nothing. Not even nothing. I don't even know if you can make a artwork about nothing that would actually be about nothing, because even nothing is a topic, okay? So in good films, there is always a directness that entirely frees us from the itch to interpret. I don't think so. Not entirely. I feel like a scene can do that, but in an entire movie, girl? Be for real. Be honest. Be honest here. The fact that films have not been overrun by interpreters is in part due simply to the newness of cinema as an art. But also you have to understand that, okay, let's say that it is like it's 60s, 70s, whatever, when she wrote this, right? And yes, the movies haven't been overrun with interpreters yet. However, at the same time, when you look at it, really, it's not like it is a better artwork because it hasn't been interpreted or overrun by interpreters. And the directness of movies are usually due to the directness of the narrative, which is something that arguably kind of been removed from conversations of visual art, at least when we talk about form specifically. So basically, I got a lot of issues. It's the same thing, like I like wrote notes fucking everywhere. Like, for example, there's this point where she goes, once upon a time, say for Dante, it must have been a revolutionary and creative move to design works of art so they might be experienced on several levels, which is something I personally enjoy in art, so I'm gonna die on this hill, okay? Now it is not. It reinforces the principle of redundancy that is the principal affliction of modern life, which is, I mean, redundancy is an affliction of modern life. I'm not going to deny that. But what I did write, I was like, several levels does not mean the same message, though. It does not mean that you just reinstate the same fucking thing over and over and over and over again. That's what I don't understand. Like, there's some kind of assumption going on here about the works that she's discussing, which doesn't make any sense to me, because I feel like, to me, the fact that you can engage with the work on multiple levels is the fact that on the top level, there are some things that people who have not studied this or do not watch fucking 100 movies a month would understand. And then there's more and more layers that comment on specific things that maybe not everybody gives a fuck about, that you have to have a certain background to understand. So it would be a different level of understanding or a different level of engagement, but does not actually mean that it would be the same meaning, though, or the same message, or even the same reason for existence in that movie or that piece of art in general. Anyway, this is so dumb. I don't know why I'm even talking about this. Not the essay. The essay still honestly tickled my brain. Like, I have opinions. And I do love a work, an essay that makes me disagree or agree, have opinions in general. That's a good thing, because, for example, watching essays on YouTube right now, it's just kind of a nothing burger. No actual takes or opinions, because everything used to be watered down to such rudimentary levels that it's genuinely fucking useless to even make. And I understand why it's happening, because I am also under the influence of that. For example, cannot just be like, Susan Sontag, whatever, let's talk about it, and then make at least fucking $50 on a video, like on my main channel or whatever. Like, I have to be like, what's trending? How can I tie it to pop culture so we can actually get more people interested in this conversation? This has been a long one. And for what, bitch? I don't know. Anyway, hope you're having a good week. If you are from my main channel, recommend me something that you would want me to talk about that would actually do well on YouTube, because this girlie has niche interests that don't always work for YouTube, and I have to constantly kind of like bend myself out of shape to come up with something that would actually perform. So, help out a girly to market herself. Have a good day. I'll see you next week or the week after that. Bye.